RCR with Paul Brennan, Reality Check Radio.
Dr. Joe Batty has a background as a general practitioner, a psychotherapist, and a mind-body connection specialist. And she's bringing the heart back into medicine with her work as a psychedelic-assisted therapist, or PAT. And she's cautiously optimistic that we will see ethical and accessible psilocybin-assisted therapy in New Zealand in the next 5 years. So we've invited Joe onto RCR to try and get an understanding of psychedelic-assisted therapy, how that can be used to improve mental health and well-being in New Zealand and around the world. Joe, welcome to RCR. Thanks for coming on our Health Hacks.
Thank you. I'm really excited to share this topic with you.
Okay. I've taken a lot of things in my life, but not magic mushrooms, because that's what we're talking about, isn't it?
Yeah.
But so, I know plenty of people who have, and I've almost been there. But what I hear people say about it is it can be an incredible experience. For some, it sort of opens some sort of portal in their consciousness, takes it to a higher level, a newer dimension. And I've become aware recently that there is some therapeutic benefit from it, especially when it comes to mental illness. So is that a kind of a generally an accurate understanding of what it's about?
Yes. So there's increasing research coming through. So particularly research on treatment-resistant depression and psilocybin.
Mm. Mm.
So it has been rescheduled in Australia. So they're offering psychedelic-assisted therapy for depression with psilocybin and MDMA for PTSD.
Oh, okay. Right.
So that has been available for applications for the last year. So it's still quite a slow process. There needs to be a psychiatrist on site. So it does mean that the cost can be upwards of $20,000 for one or two treatment doses.
Really? That much?
Mm. Mm.
It's very expensive.
Yeah. So we've got research studies coming through here. There's a microdosing for LSD study happening in Auckland. So, yeah, I guess we can start by, you know, there's a lot of talk about microdosing. So I think it's pretty on trend in places like Silicon Valley to be microdosing to improve focus and productivity. But really, if we want to move forward with mental health and visit these expanded states of consciousness, then a larger dose where yeah. we actually get these psychedelic visions. We might go to dark, shadowy places to revisit traumas. And the idea is to then have the opportunity to get peace with that trauma.
Yeah.
So we might get a chance to redo the trauma and yell at an abuser, run away, and then get peace with that.
Also, you can kind of virtually reenact in a conscious way, or I don't know how you'd put it, but almost like sort of putting yourself back into the movie and kind of redoing it and having a slightly different outcome and then sort of calming the storm of trauma that way.
That's where preparation. So in the research, they do about three preparation sessions. So you get to know the therapist. They have had two therapists working in a dyad to just for potential accusations, or the medicines can enhance sexual themes. So we want to keep the therapist and the participant safe.
Yep.
But if you've built up a relationship and you've the therapist has got a timeline of potential traumas in a lifetime, then the therapist can encourage that person to move towards a situation that they've maybe not resolved.
Mm.
So if we look at trauma and how the brain can't differentiate between a flashback or a memory,
right,
of something scary that happened to us and whether it's actually happening right now.
Okay. So you have to, what is it, an intellectual exercise, a layer up from that to work out what's real and what's not?
That's the mind. Yeah. So, yeah. So I guess a lot of this, so I resonate with internal family systems, which is using the younger parts of ourselves.
Yeah.
And unburdening those wounds that we carry.
When you say the younger part, that we're talking memories, are we? Memories from a younger time of our life, is that what you mean?
Yeah, so experiences from a younger age.
Yeah, okay.
So that we, you know, a lot of traumatic memory gets buried because as children we have to choose quite early on whether we can be authentic or whether we need to attach to our adult carers.
Right.
So quite often we change our behaviour to make sure that we're loved and cared for.
Okay, and you can understand why we would do that.
Mm.
It's a survival thing in the end, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. So we have to suppress a lot of these parts of ourselves. So we might be told that we think we'll be told we're too much, or that when we think that we're not worthy of love unless we're a good girl, good boy.
Hmm.
So,
and we can think when we're young that we've caused things that we haven't too, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So these toxic beliefs, it's too scary for a child to believe there's something wrong with their caregiver. So they embody that there's something wrong with them.
Yeah. And that gets packed down.
Totally. Right?
But it's still there.
Yeah.
Somewhere.
And so I was privileged to be at the trauma conference in Christchurch in March with Bessel van der Kolk, who's in his 80s. So he wrote the book, The Body Keeps the Score, and how we can have, so a memory might have an emotion, it might be held in a place in our body. So he did put a lot of funding into researching yoga and somatic practices for trauma, and they've proved that that's helpful. So he was part of research into MDMA, and he was very skeptical, and he had very traumatized people with complex trauma from childhood, and his experience has been that nothing much works for that.
Mm.
But he saw firsthand that these medicines can somehow open a critical window where we're able to heal from trauma.
MDMA, that's ecstasy, isn't it?
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah, known as ecstasy. All right. Aptly named, maybe. I don't know. What is happening in the brain? Because I've seen a few interviews of people describing the effects of psilocybin, and some had experiences where they actually predicted something. They saw something happen in their vision while under the influence of this that then later on actually happened, a very unlikely scenario. So it was, like I said at the beginning, like some kind of portal had opened up that transcended normal consciousness and awareness. Is that what happens? Is this what's going on in people's brains when they have this?
So potentially, so we're still studying the effects on the brain. So I think what you're talking about is like a clairvoyance, a clairsentience. seeing the future. And a lot of us have probably got that gift.
Right. So don't dismiss that, is what you say.
No. So as children, we, you know, often it's quite common for children to sense dead people or have these experiences, and that kind of gifting is often shut down.
Right. Okay.
So we know that psychedelics activate the 5-HT2A receptor. So they activate that. So that's serotonin. So they directly activate serotonin receptors. And the 2A receptor is distributed in a large proportion of the brain. So when we look at existing treatments, like the serotonin reuptake inhibitors, which is your Prozac, escitalopram, basically for 30 years we haven't had very much new medication. So those medications, all they do is they increase the serotonin in the gap between the nerve endings. So this is why they may have a little bit of an effect, but only slightly better than placebo, which is a sugar pill. And so they, because it's just the amount sitting in the gap, the body adapts to that. And so they stop working, that you need to have more of them. And there's so many people that have stayed on this medication. And so they tend to have a drop in sex drive. They can sweat a lot. And a lot of people describe that their mood is flat.
Yeah, I've seen that. I've seen that with a relative who was on Prozac, flatlined their personality for a while. It was so obvious.
Yeah, so it's like almost they're deadened inside.
Yeah.
So I certainly wouldn't recommend anybody stopping these sorts of medications suddenly, but I think there is a call to slowly de-prescribe medications. So certainly that's my experience as a GP after we had the earthquakes here in Christchurch. I wanted to help people. I started them on citalopram, and then we had other events and they were still on those medications. So they were already on the maximum dose. So it was very hard. So just emphasizing that there is no quick fix.
Yeah.
So no. I had all these tools. I could teach meditation, mindfulness. Once people had been given that piece of paper, they just tuned out.
It's interesting that, isn't it?
Mm.
How that works. So what's holding back, you know, a wholesale, I don't know, trial or experimentation, or I don't know the word you use, of, you know, psychedelics in treatment, you know, LSD psilocybin and ecstasy. What's holding, I mean, if the other stuff hits a threshold and then doesn't work, what's the point in carrying on? You've got to find something that works. What's holding everybody back? Maybe there isn't anything.
So I will quote from what Terence McKenna said in 1987 after psychedelics had been made illegal.
Mm.
So he said, psychedelics are illegal because they dissolve opinion structures and culturally lay down models of behavior and information processing. They open you up to the possibility that everything you know is wrong.
I can't have that. In fact, that might be why drugs and alcohol are treated differently, because it's easy to control drunk people. They don't have many great ideas while they're drunk, do they?
No. And it's actually really toxic to the brain. There's a high risk of domestic violence. You know, it's a real problem in society that I see part of this process with the psychedelic therapy or healing mental illness is coming back to gathering as a community and having sober experiences.
Yeah.
So creating belonging, having sharing circles where we can be vulnerable, we can take off our masks, we can be our real selves and be seen and heard. So that's what we needed as children, was to have our needs met and to be seen and heard for our authentic selves.
Yeah. I mean, some of us might have got that, but many didn't. So what needs to happen for this to be mainstream in New Zealand?
So we need legislative change, because these are highly illegal. I'm not sure exactly what class they are. So,
well, they'll be class A, wouldn't they? They'd be right at the top.
Yeah. So we have, you know, I'm confident that we will follow behind Australia. We have the Australasian Association for Psychiatrists. So we're looking at Australia to make sure that they don't mess it up. And so I trained with Mind Medicine Australia in Melbourne, and they have, so it needs to be the psychiatrist that goes through all these hoops to get permission. So it's still pretty slow. So I think there's only a handful of psychiatrists that have got permission to use these drugs. They've been cautious, which is good. But I think it is, realistically, it is going to take a good 3 to 5 years over there to roll this out. So we do have studies. And so I know that they had permission in Christchurch. That was limited who was eligible for the studies, because they were on these other medications.
Oh, so you can't have anyone on other medications.
So they're looking into it. There's so much research happening all around the world. So the studies have excluded people on the SSRI medications because they likely reduce the effectiveness of the medicine which works on these serotonin receptors.
Yeah.
So
but that medication's part of a business model as well, isn't it? We should never forget that.
Mm.
And they're selling plenty, aren't they?
Oh yes, they're making plenty of money. So I like the work of Simon Jungler, has just written a book, Psychedelics and the Soul. So, if I quote from his book, removing the soul from psychedelics by reducing them to molecules or psychological tools reveals both a poverty of the imagination and an inability to move beyond materialistic and economically driven models of healing.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I'll tell you why. When I was recovering from cancer, I boiled up marijuana leaves in butter and administered them. I had throat cancer, so I had to drip it down. It was the only thing I could take that gave me sleep and stopped the morphine fog and hassle I was having. And I have debated it with people along the way to, you know, inform them of how well it worked. And I've noticed that there's this need to divorce the actual effect of the drug, the, you know, the trippy part of the drug, from its mechanical effectiveness. And I'm saying, no, that's part of the treatment. That's, you need to take your brain and your senses to somewhere else a bit as well for it to work. So you just reading that out sort of registered with me. There's always this need to try and divorce the effect, you know, the actual experience from, yeah, the molecular mechanics of it. It's curious, isn't it? How we like to always do that.
So when they're trying to commercialize psychedelic therapy, they're trying to study it without the actual therapy.
Yeah,
so there's a push.
Well put. Yeah,
there's a push with ketamine, and then there's also MEO-DMT is now coming into studies, and they're trying to prove that it works without therapy. And what I would like to emphasize is that if you've got a good preparation and good integration, you don't need a lot of the medicine.
Yeah.
And, you know, probably 20% is the medicine, 40% is that preparation, 40% is the integration.
Yeah. No, I hear you. And we don't know how many people are self-medicating even at this level, do we really?
No, I think there's certainly quite a lot of underground retreats. So we're seeing a lot of ayahuasca coming out of the jungle. So we need to be very, very mindful of who to trust. So just because somebody names themselves a shaman doesn't mean that they've got
they know what they're doing. Yeah.
Exactly. So, you know, certainly it's quite commercialized even in South America to go to expensive retreats. And ayahuasca is not a, in my opinion, is not an entry level psychedelic.
Right. Okay. It's
from what I've heard, you know, there's quite intense themes, entities, you know, people purge. And with psilocybin, you've got pretty minimal side effects. So there might be a bit of headache, nausea. We've got a, with all of these medicines, we've got probably about a 2% risk of hallucinogen persisting perceptive disorder.
Okay, that means it carries on.
Yeah, so it's pretty low. So the, you know, we have to counsel people that they may have a permanent change in their worldview.
But that might not be a bad thing.
Exactly, but we, you know, we just need to.
You got to tell them. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think as facilitators, we need to have one foot in the ethics and training and practices, and then be open to these mystical, magical, awe-inspiring experiences. You
well,
know,
there does seem to be something magical about it from how people talk, almost spiritual. It connects with something that we're not connecting with usually, right? I mean, that seems to be that way.
Yeah, and I think we need, well, you know, we've lost that. We've lost our connection to the fact that we're living beings connected to the living earth. We've had colonialization extracting as much to make money, and we've kind of lost biodiversity. We've got the collapse of ecosystems, this collapse of community and rituals, belonging. So I think we're at a precarious crossroads.
Okay. If people are listening and thinking, I need to try this, is it possible for them to do that legally or in any sort of way that has supervision or makes clinical or scientific sense, or do they just have to, you know, find a way of doing it themselves? But you've probably already answered this, but where are we at here in New Zealand for people who want to try?
So we do have research. We do have legal ketamine, and that I do know of a GP using that in a hospice situation for end-of-life anxiety. So it doesn't really resonate with me, but I am hearing that there's quite mystical and helpful experiences happening with ketamine. So that can be intramuscular, there's gummies. I've heard of people being sent home with gummies by a psychiatrist and they didn't realise that they wouldn't be able to go to work.
Right.
So I guess ketamine it only lasts for 2 hours. So if you're doing that in a clinic setting, it fits more with your 9 to 5. So if we think about psilocybin and MDMA, the experience tends to last for up to 6 hours.
Okay. So have a day free.
Yeah. And so when we use the medicines in, say, the morning, we have a therapist, we stay hydrated, we stay safe, whereas recreational use, so I was at university in Sheffield, so we had the rave, the ecstasy culture.
Yeah.
So people would stay up all night and then maybe have a bit of a blue day a day or two later because they've lost that sleep, they weren't hydrated and things. So the downside with LSD is that it does last for maybe up to 12 hours. So makes it a little bit harder. And I guess that has maybe got that taint from the 60s.
It sure has. Yep. Still.
Yeah. So we need to kind of open our minds to the fact that this has got great potential.
It's been really fascinating hearing about it. Thank you so much for coming on, Dr. Jo Batty, and informing us. Really interesting. 5 years, you reckon?
Who knows? Yeah. Hopefully. And I think, so we've got states in the US where, so we've got Oregon, Colorado, and so decriminalization, and so people are allowed to cultivate their own mushrooms, and share them, and so they're not allowed to be sold, and so you've got. But so there's, you know, different states are allowed, and under federal law they're still illegal, but it's this criminalization. So if we could move forward, I think that's probably the best way forward for us, because there's going to be less of this commercial money-grabbing situation.
Which has sort of happened with cannabis, right? We've seen that sort of with cannabis in the way that's medically developed recently here anyway.
Yeah. So for medical use, and that's what's happening in Canada's quite, I think, Canada's hopefully going to lead the way. So they've had it for quite a few years that you can seek permission to be allowed to take magic mushrooms for end-of-life anxiety.
Right. I can understand that. Yeah.
Yeah. So there's a couple of movies with the title Dosed, DOSED, and that has a lady using magic mushrooms for her cancer journey.
Right. Yeah. It just reminded me, the Rogan podcast I saw with a guy talking about taking mushrooms and the predictive nature of it that I mentioned earlier, he had a vision of this huge field in Canada with dead cattle everywhere. That was his vision. And he thought it was the most unlikely vision. Fast forward a couple of years and he's hiking in Canada and there's a flood down a river, like some sort of dam gave way, this flood. And right in front of him, before his eyes, this scene that he had a vision of a few years before played out, with all this cattle from all the fields and the farms along the river being washed into this field in front of him. I mean, how unlikely is that?
Mm.
So it makes you wonder. All right, it's been a fascinating conversation. Thank you, Dr. Jo Batty, for coming on.
Thank you for inviting me.
The RCR shop has great gift ideas, from great-looking tees, hoodies, caps, tote bags, bumper stickers and more, the RCR shop is now open at www.realitycheck.radio/shop.